Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 53 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again is Hal Bryan from the Rocketeer Minute. Welcome back, Hal.
Thanks, Rob. It's fun to be back.
Yes. We've had some very interesting conversations over the last few days, and let's hope we're going to continue doing that for the rest of this week. So far, I'm enjoying myself. I hope you are too. And obviously, I hope all the listeners are too. So episode 53 begins with John trying to get some more info and ends with lots of R2 sounds. So, you know, we ended things yesterday with John making a quip at Stewart, where he basically said, blow me. And then today finishes with, how much drug money is Esperanza paying you to turn traitor? So, first of all, that's a very interesting. I mean, John is once again showing that he is the smartest man in the room. You know, he's the one who's able to put everything together and figure it all out. No one else is coming even close to figuring it all out. You know, about, yes, I mean, we know that everyone in the tower knows they're talking about Esperanza and stuff like that. But, you know, John also doesn't care what anyone thinks. He's going to say his mind, you know, and he wants to talk about drug money. He wants to talk about, you know, that Esperanza is paying Stewart and his men. Why not? You know, he doesn't mind pissing off the bad guy. That's what I guess it comes down to. Right. You know, he did a good enough job of pissing off Hans Gruber. 2 years earlier. So what's another guy? Yeah. Who cares?
Yeah. I think he's pretty well over it at this point.
Yeah, that's true. Stewart responds by saying, I think Colonel Richelieu said it best. Treason is merely a matter of dates. This country's got to learn that it can't keep cutting the legs off of men like General Esperanza, men who have the guts to stand up against communist aggression. So, you know, it makes me start thinking about, okay, the whole idea of treason and being a traitor and stuff like that. You know, so the official explanation of what someone of treason is, it's the crime of attacking a state authority to which one owes allegiance. Okay, this typically includes acts such as participating in a war against one's native country, attempting to overthrow its government, spying on its military, its diplomats, or its secret services for a hostile and foreign power, or attempting to kill its heads of state. A person who commits treason is known in law as a traitor. Now, I never thought about that there's like a law term that you would call someone a traitor. You know, like you know, everyone knows who's the first traitor you would think of if someone says to you a traitor, an American traitor. What's the first name that pops into your mind?
Everybody thinks of Benedict Arnold.
That's correct. Benedict Arnold. There you go. And, you know, it's really interesting that the term traitor is actually, you know, a law term.
Right. Well, it strikes me as it's somewhat analogous to the idea that certainly, you know, probably early in the 20th century, terms like idiot, imbecile, moron had very specific definitions and were, you know, almost medical diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And, you know, and they just sort of devolve into, you know, insults that when I was a kid seemed pretty, you know, pretty harsh and pretty serious. Don't seem to be nearly so much so now. But there were like specific IQ ratings. If you're in this category, you're mm-hmm. this, and if you're that, you're that. So interesting that you, oh, someone's a traitor. You know, they committed treason. But yes, that there does have to be a very specific legal definition behind it.
Right. I mean, there's also two types of treason. There's high treason and petty treason. You know, you'd think it would be called high treason and low treason, but
right. But petty is so great.
High treason is if you're being disloyal against the monarch or something, you know, of a high level in government, or something that's a little lower is known as petty treason. You know, basically most places around the world don't even think of the word petty treason anymore. Treason is high treason. You know, that's what you refer to. In England, according to the law in England, someone who commits high treason will be punished by being hanged, drawn, and quartered for men, or burnt at the stake for women. And sometimes they would behead people for these type of things. But they abolished these penalties in 1814. There were monarchs later on that wanted to continue using it against traitors. But nowadays we would just be consider those people dissidents as opposed to traitors. I guess it really depends on, how you look at what they've done. What is it considered? In America, obviously, the whole idea of treason is someone's is also it's punishable by death. That was also hanging, as we mentioned earlier. That goes with Benedict Arnold. There was a slave in Virginia who joined the British. His name was Billy, who they caught, and he was eventually pardoned by Thomas Jefferson, who was the governor of Virginia. Because people tried convincing him that because of the fact that he wasn't a citizen and didn't enjoy any of the benefits of being one, so he owed no loyalty to Virginia, and therefore it wasn't treason what he did, which is very interesting. It's
Right.
basically,
Well, and it kind of underscores the quote. It's a matter of dates. It's also a matter of perspective. You know,
yes.
one man's treason is another man's heroic rebellion.
That's correct. I think George Carlin says it the best. He has one of his things where he talks about, that he talks about things about different perspectives. For instance, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. Things like that.
Right.
He has a whole diatribe. I mean, I love George Carlin's diatribes. I don't necessarily agree with everything that he says, but I just love the way that he delivers it. Because
He
his
was fantastic at
that's
that.
right. His jokes were commentary on the world and politics and things like that. And even if you don't agree with his politics 100%, there's logic to the things that he says and the way that he makes his connections between things. So
Right.
that's really cool. And so the at this point, we mentioned that Stuart gives the quote from Cardinal Richelieu. Now, do you know who Cardinal Richelieu was?
Well, we know him best as the bad guy in various incarnations of the Three Musketeers,
Correct.
but it was a real world character in was it 17th century France,
Yes, that's correct.
and not to spoil anything, but I don't think he ever said that.
Probably not.
I think that quote was attributed to let me double check my notes on the name.
Benedict Arnold.
Well, Benedict Arnold, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand Perigord
Ooh.
Was the Frenchman who actually said treason is a matter of dates, and then Alexandre Dumas picked it up later and attributed it in his novel in the Count of Monte Cristo.
Okay, that actually makes a lot of sense. So Cardinal Richelieu was a he was born in 1585 and died in 1642. And his full name is Armand Jean du Plessis, the Duke of Richelieu. He was a French statesman and clergyman, and he was known as the L'Eminence Rouge, the Red Eminence, which because he was a cardinal and they wore red robes, that's why he was referred to by that. And he was the chief minister to Louis XIII, and that's why he pops up quite often in the Three Musketeers. He's pretty much known as the bad guy of the Three Musketeers in just about every single incarnation of it. I mean, Alexandre Dumas wrote the novel in 1844. So we're just talking 200 years later, and he decided that Richelieu was going to be his bad guy. Now, there's something that I read re recently that one of the funniest things is that during the age of the Hays Code, you couldn't have any clergyman being a bad guy, so they changed it, and he wasn't a clergyman. They gave him like a different job. He wasn't a
Oh,
priest.
wow.
I'm trying to remember what he was instead. I right now can't remember what he was, but the idea is that he couldn't be a bad
Sure. Isn't that amazing?
Yes, he's known as also saying the famous line again, whether if he really said it or not, but in many different adaptations where he says the pen is mightier than the sword. And he was also, how many different sightings in IMDb do you think Cardinal Richelieu has?
Ooh.
Okay. Like there are X number of movies and TV shows that Cardinal that Richelieu is a character.
Boy, I have a feeling I'm going to be really on the low side, but I'm going to be conservative and say a dozen.
94.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was only off by, what, 82.
Yeah, well, that's fine. That's I never would have guessed this either. You know, that there it's unbelievable how many. I mean, he was in Cyrano de Bergerac. Like they just threw him into a whole bunch of different other stories that took place around that time. You know, you'd
constantly, I was just saying, anywhere near there, let's throw him in, and he can usually be a bad guy.
That's right. So that's I find that really interesting. You know, that they're able to just throw him into all these places. So why not?
Why not?
Yeah, and then John's response to Stuart is, and lesson one starts with killing policemen. What's lesson two? The neutron bomb. And you know, we get a little smirk from William Sadler, and he goes, no, I think we can find something in between. Watch this. And then he snaps his fingers at one of his men, and he goes, give me a flight number, one that's low on fuel. You know, and the guy that he's talking to is Thompson, who we saw earlier in the movie. He had a little small part, but he didn't really have anything to say. And what we get to see is when he places his finger on like the little cards with the flight numbers, which again, we got to give them a lot of credit that they're able to print all this out and know what planes are flying and whatever. You know, you take over the airport and you're able to get all of these little plastic sheets that have the names of all the flights that are supposed to be coming in at this time. You know, they definitely did a lot of research on this one. You know, we see that there's a flight from London, which is, it says WSA 114, which is Windsor Airline 114. You have another one, NWA, Northwest Airlines, because, you know, Holly is on Northeast. And then you have SKW. So I'm not really sure which of these, you know, which these planes are. Do you know any of the like abbreviations that they have on these things? Do they mean anything to you if you're looking at them?
So you can, looking at them, as far as I know, they're all fictional, with the possible exception of Northwest Airlines,
right,
which they were Northwest Orient when they started and then just went strictly to Northwest. So their letters may have been NWA, but certainly all the liveries that you see on all the, you know, all the airliners are fictional, which is
right,
which is pretty standard.
Correct. No, that I know, but I'm saying if you're looking at these little plastic cards for each of the flights, all the other information that's there, does anything, you know, jump out at you? I mean, I'm asking because I don't know. I didn't do any research on this. I'm not testing you.
No,
I'm just wondering.
I don't feel tested. No, apologies.
I'm wondering if
names themselves. So I'm scrubbing through here. Give me 1 second. Let me sort of bring
okay,
that.
Okay, it's at second 36.
36.
You can see it.
So, so interestingly, so we do see an aircraft type. So the WSA 114 is listed as a 747.
Mm-hmm.
And you see the starting point and the planned destination. So it's London to Dulles. So that should be
right.
Oh gosh,
we talked about that. I talked about this a few weeks ago. Okay. IAD is the call sign for Dulles.
That's correct for Dulles, but that's not correct for London. London Heathrow.
Oh, okay.
Is
right.
It's off.
It's probably HEA or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's right on the tip of my tongue. But anyway, so I see aircraft type, flight type, you know. Not sure what, you know, see, and above it, we see that NWA 46 is a Boeing 757. I don't know if we ever get a clear shot at the flight below it.
No, it just says SKW 50.
Yeah.
50 question mark.
Which I would
502.
Yeah, which I would guess if this were real life, it could be Sky West if they were around back then. You do maybe. See some things on the far right of the strip. You see it more on the SKW one. You just see plus and then DRCT. That stands for direct. So that would be their filed flight plan routing. It's going from this waypoint direct to that one and then to this waypoint. And waypoints can be airplanes, or excuse me, airports. Waypoints can be airports. They can be navigational radio stations. They can be intersections, which are defined on a map, back then defined by the crossing of two, usually two sort of, if you imagine, beams from two different radio stations where they intersect. We can define an intersection there. Now, of course, we use GPS waypoints to define those intersections. But so some of that stuff is certainly familiar. One of the numbers on there, but I'm not seeing anything that. Well, actually, that first four-digit number, so that 7315. That could be, and then 4730 on WC-104. And I don't think this is referenced in the film. I can't remember for sure, but that could very well be a transponder code or a squawk code. So you've got
The SKW has the same thing. They have the same numbers.
Oh, it does have the same
numbers. The SKW. So, it's 4730, and then you can also see it's P1750 underneath. Yeah, so they just got sloppy, you're saying.
That's very possible, but I mean, that being a transponder code is just a guess, because those numbers is a four-digit number, and each column can be 0 through 7. So that 7315 and 4730 are both possible transponder codes, but yeah, they would never ever be duplicated by aircraft in the same under the same control authority. So. And you would never see 7500, 7600, or 7700. Those are reserved for emergencies, like general emergency or lost communications or hijacking.
Well, an emergency is about to happen. So I don't know. Right. Maybe they. No, but I mean, I'm still very curious how they actually get this information. But that's neither here nor there. They have good intelligence, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's what it boils down to. They've got access to the FAA computers, can look at flight plans, but you know, they went to a lot of trouble to you know, you imagine the actual process on site in this church, or they're prep for printing the little strips, as they call them, with the
right.
clear things with the numbers on them and stuff. And you think, hey, we don't really care about getting anybody anywhere on time. We're gonna just mess with everybody, but
that's right. Did they really use these plastic strips?
So, again, a better question for my buddy, the ex-controller. The only ones that I've ever seen in person were actually on white pieces of paper. But it was that same sort of thing. You have a rectangular sheet like that, and then you sort of stack them up and, you know, physically hand them off in the room from one person to another when they're taking over. Or, you know, that flight has gone into that person's sector, that kind of thing. So, yeah, the concept of strips is generally correct.
Okay, great.
I wish I was an expert on exactly what's contained on them, but I just know it in broad strokes.
I mean, again, it could just be complete BS. Everything is there. You know, there's no way of knowing whether they really did their due diligence here or not.
Sure.
Stewart says, give me a flight number one that's low on fuel. And then the response that he gets from Thompson is Windsor 114. Transatlantic from London. Fuel tanks dry as a martini. Stuart looks at him and says, activate the ILS landing system, but recalibrate sea level. -200 feet. You know, and I love the way that he says this in a very calm manner. You know, this is just a regular everyday type of thing that you're going to, you know, change the ILS, landing system. Now, can you do that really?
No.
Do you know?
No, that is that's probably the
single biggest. In 1990, could you? No. In 1990, could you do it?
Well, you could if you had construction crews going out to a series of antennas and, like, physically, you know, tearing them down, rebuilding them, reconfiguring them, you know, all sorts of things like that. And even still, it would be really, really tough to get something that would direct you to, you know, sort of below ground. You could do something where, in theory back then, the angle would have been too steep, you know, or too shallow. To do what they wanted to do, the quote-unquote simplest thing would have been to install new antennas a mile away from the airport, so that if you follow, you know, you follow that path down where you expect to see ground, you'd okay. hit something farther away, rather than this sort of concept of magically lowering the whole thing with a computer. So that to me is this, that's the second biggest plot hole in the movie, after airplanes not just going to other airports.
Right. Okay, that's fair. But again, it's the even though we know it's not real, it's an interesting to do it, especially sure. especially for most of us who don't know enough about aviation. Like, okay, I guess they can do that. Even though when you think about it, it would just be completely crazy to be able to do something like that.
Well, and the concept of you know, saying these are terrorists and they're going to do something horrible, and the horrible thing they're going to do is to somehow tamper with this whole system to the point where, you know, pilots are flying airplanes into the ground without even realizing it. I mean, that's a big, scary, you know, high concept thing to have terrorists do. And it's, you know, so on in that level, it's an excellent and, you know, creepy plot yeah. device.
That's true. I mean, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier this week. You know, you have to take the ideas within the movie at face value, even though you know in our reality, it doesn't work that way. You know, that type of thing. And I mean, Thompson, as he's given this order, doesn't look too happy that he's being told to do this, but, you know, he still follows the orders. And then the rest of this minute is just Thompson flipping a whole bunch of switches, you know, turning a dial. You know, we get all these sound effects that basically sound like there's something coming out of Star Wars. You know, it sounds like R2-D2 or something like that, making all these little blips and bleeps and things like that. And that's pretty much how this minute ends. Did you have anything else for this minute that you wanted to discuss?
No, I think we hit it. I mean, it's kind of that pivotal thing. I do remember, you know, I remember so clearly seeing this in the theater and that moment of, you know, we're lowering it by 200 feet. You know, we're going to recalibrate it minus 200 feet. And, you know, before stopping and you know, I nitpick it and call that a plot hole. But honestly, I'd been an instrument rated pilot, which means I'm qualified to use an ILS or an instrument landing system for about a year. And it was still all pretty fresh in my mind. And yeah, the idea of somehow or other trusting the gauges and then, you know, being flown straight into the ground was,
yeah,
you know, that was horrifying, you know, until I stopped to think, okay, how plausible it is. So it was I keep wanting to say, well, it's a good hook. No, it's obviously a terrible thing to think about, but in the context of a movie where you've got bad guys doing bad things,
yeah,
it was,
that's true.
It was a good choice.
All right, and so the script is pretty much word for word. You know, there isn't that many differences here. The one biggest difference is the order that Stewart gives to recalibrate actually happens 2 pages later in the script. You know, it's interesting the way that they do that, and the response from Thompson when he's asked to give him a flight number low on fuel. He just hands him a slip of paper. Stewart reads it and switches to another mic or frequency, and that's all it says. It doesn't say anything about him saying that the fuel tank's dry as a martini or anything like that. You know, they just completely skip over that thing. I mean, I don't know if Thompson himself would have made up that ad lib or something like that, or they decided along the way to do that. Another difference in this minute, in the script in this minute, is that when Stewart starts talking about Esperanza, he says, "Men with the guts to stand up to Soviet aggression." as opposed to communist aggression. But I can understand why they would change that in 1990. You know, that's, you know.
Right. Well, it was, you know, the Soviet Union had what, about that's a year
right.
when this
movie That's came right. out, I mean, the Berlin Wall already came down. So it was like, it was getting there. But all the rest is exactly the same.
Yeah.
So every Wednesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Aviation Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that is somehow related to aviation, whether it's on a plane, whether it's in an airport. I'm sure you've got tons of those stories, Hal, but I hope you were able to think of one can give us.
Yeah, the challenge for me was definitely narrowing anything down. I've had my misadventures as a commercial airline traveler, just like everybody else as well. But, I've been very, very fortunate both professionally and personally to be able to fly a lot of different types of airplanes. And that's something that's very meaningful to me. But, I suppose the one thing, and it's not necessarily much of a story, but I can tell you it was my most meaningful day of flying. Would have been in, it was the fall of 2008, and I'd made some friends up in Canada who collected and restored vintage biplanes from the 30s and 40s, in particular an airplane called the de Havilland Tiger Moth, which is... since I was a little kid and has been one of my very, very favorite airplanes. And it was an airplane that I dreamt of flying and, you know, just hoped that one day the opportunity would come along. Made some, through a mutual friend, made friends with this group up in Canada and ended up going to visit them. And they, we got along great. They took me in, so to speak, and, adopted me as one of the gang. Then I went and got a Canadian pilot license to validating my U.S. certificate up there, and was able to get checked out and fly their 60, 70 year old airplanes at the time. So the great day of flying was I was able to get both my wife and my now late father up there at the same time. So I could give each of them and my dad, who had an illustrious flying career, goes back to the late 40s.
Oh, wow.
I was able to give them both their first rides in this type. It was a 1941 de Havilland Tiger Moth. So that was in 2008, and it's resonated with me. Very, very special to me. There's video of me doing those flights, and when my dad is on the ground, you see him off kind of toward the end of the runway with a camera, and he's snapping pictures like crazy. And that's one of the only ways I have where I've got like evidence that say, yeah, he was actually kind of proud of me. I can show him sitting there taking pictures. And then the coda to the story is now 15 years after that flight, I'm in the process of buying that very airplane.
Oh, wow.
So that's going to be coming into the family probably this fall. Wonderful, just a very romantic era for me. The design dating back to the early 30s, this one built in 1941, used to train pilots who went on to fly in all the Commonwealth air forces, the Royal Canadian Air Force, British Royal Air Force, et cetera, et cetera. So there's the nostalgia there, but then of course that individual airplane being meaningful to me as it was, was able to give dad his first ride in the type, give my wife her first ride in the type. And then now she and I will be flying it together a lot sometime, hopefully, as I said, around this fall.
Wow. That's really cool.
So that airplane has a movie connection as well. And I know we're going to be talking about some movies, I think, tomorrow. But I'm not giving away my list, but I will say there's a movie with Robert Redford called The Great Waldo Pepper. And there are two, there's more than two, but there's a couple of sort of notable crash scenes in there where pilots flying a Curtis Jenny, which even in the early 70s was very, very rare and unusual. This is an airplane from the teens. Pilots have to be shown crashing these airplanes, so they actually used stunt double airplanes. So you've got real Curtis Jennys and standard J-1s flying throughout the film, but when it's time for one to crash, they used a de Havilland Tiger Moth, which was more available and more prevalent and frankly just a lot less valuable back then. So they made it up. They did a credible job making it to look like the other airplane and then truly crashed it on film. So the one that I'm talking about, the one that I'm buying, flew in 1973, crashes into a bog in the Great Waldo Pepper, and then got torn apart, put in storage, didn't fly again until 2006. And it was shortly thereafter that, you know, just 2 years later that I was able to fly it and give those rides in it. And now it'll be ours and be in our hangar.
Wow.
Before long.
How many planes do you have?
This is our first in terms of ownership.
You just said my hangar. So I thought maybe it's like, you know, I'm sorry to make the connection, but it sounds like, you know, someone has a barn. So it's like here, these are the horses I have in the barn. You know, so I was thinking.
Sure. Yeah, it's.
I was thinking that was your comment.
Yeah, so we're having a hangar built to house this airplane.
Oh, okay.
So there was a family airplane that I grew up around and things, but in terms of specifically belonging to me and my wife, this will be the first.
All right, very cool. Thank you very much for that story, Al. So you want to once again tell people where they can find you?
Well, you can find me all over the place. As you're listening to this, it's the middle of Air Venture Week here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, largest aviation event in the world. 650-some thousand people converging on our little town and 10 to 12,000 airplanes. So right now, as you're listening to this, I am running all over the place, working on publications, content, and all kinds of stuff, helping share stories about our great event at the Experimental Aircraft Association. Otherwise, you can catch up with me on many, many episodes of the Green Dot podcast, which is EAA's podcast. You find those at inspire.eaa.org or really anywhere you get your podcasts. And of course, as you mentioned at the very beginning, with Jim O'Kane, did the Rocketeer Minute, more than 100 episodes, doing a deep dive into that film easy to find out there at RocketeerMinute.com or on social media or anywhere you get your podcast.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Twitter, find me on Facebook, or you can find me on my website, MoveAroundMinute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages,